sorry I'm an alcoholic.
First, I really want to thank, I want to thank you for having me here. I've had a wonderful time. It's been wonderful to meet all you guys and to not remember anybody's name. But I'm sure by the end of the week, I will know many of you pretty well. And hopefully some of you even better. I also want to thank Margaret for carting me around and explaining things to me. But I want to start, and I want to ask God to speak through me tonight. I want to ask him to get involved with my talk. I do that for one reason, because you guys didn't come here to listen to me talk, you know, because I'd lie. And it'd be all about the wonderful things that I do and how it's everybody else's fault. And how I didn't drink that bad. It was just a mistake, or I was going to outgrow it, or it was a phase. And that's not things that everybody needs to hear tonight. But what you're all here to hear about is how do I not drink day at a time and apply the principles of the program to my life? And how did one day that I wake up and I knew that was going to be the day that I wasn't going to drink again? And, you know, I don't know why I don't drink. I don't know why on September 6th, 1994, I woke up, crawled out of a basement, and I'd been drinking, so, you know, I was really hungover. I was doing some other stuff, too. I had lots of fun that night. And I crawled out of a basement, which, of course, was somebody else's because I didn't have a place to live at the time. So I crawled out of a basement, and I walked into the bright sunlight because, of course, you know it's always bright on those mornings. And I got hit with this intense strobe light of sun. And I remember, like, my skull split. I remember just holding my head in my hands and just saying, you know, those people in AA were really nice. You know, they weren't those jerks I thought they were. And maybe I should go back there. You know, and I don't know why from that day to now I haven't drank. You know, I believe that it's divine intervention. And I believe that God stepped into my life that day, and I listened. You know, God has stepped into my life many times before that day. But there was always something inside of me that thought that someday, somehow, it would be different, or that I would be immune to alcohol, or that wanted to be like other people. I so desperately wanted to be like other people. I didn't want to be different. I didn't want to have a disease that made me different than other people. You know, so all of those things kept me from listening to God. And that morning, those things didn't matter because I was dying, and I knew it. But, you know, I'm going to start where, you know, every story starts, which is in the beginning. Now, I can do the David Copperfield, which is, you know, I was born. or I can, I'll tell you a little bit about how I got to get sober on that day. First of all, I'm from New Jersey. And if anybody knows anything about New Jersey, what you see in the movies and the TV is true. We talk funny. We have big hair. We curse a lot. It's dirty. There's pollution, traffic. And those are the good things. You know, it was funny. I was reading once. I was doing a report like in school, and I read that there was like 93 toxic waste dumps in New Jersey. And I thought, wow, that's less than I thought there were. So this is where I grew up. But I grew up in, I'm one of five kids, and I'm the youngest. And my parents are surprisingly normal, you know. By, you know, if you look at me, you'd really think my parents were, you know, one was Moonbeam and the other one was, you know, Spike or something. But my parents, my father is a Teamsters truck driver. My mother's a secretary. I mean, how white bread normal could you be? I mean, you look at the outside of my house that I grew up in, and it's a little yellow house, and it's got a nice little bay window and a beautiful porch and wicker furniture and a lawn, but we have a dog, so it doesn't really have any grass on it. And it looks like a normal house, but when you went inside, it was a completely different story. You know, see, because I look normal to people. You know, Well, I did. But, no, I don't. But my life looked normal, you know? You look at my parents' house, you look at my family, well, I got five brothers and sisters. We all, you know, are mildly educated, mildly successful, married, children. I mean, you met us on the street and you wouldn't think, gee, I got to get my kids away from her. But if you knew me, you'd think, I got to get my kids away from her. But, you know, so we all looked, presented a pretty normal life, but my life or my childhood wasn't normal. And I'm not an alcoholic because of it. And the reason why I talk about this is because a lot of us come into AA, and we've got stories. Everybody's got a story. I mean, everybody has, except for Peter. Apparently he has a really nice family. But all of us come into, it's been my experience, that we all come into AA and we all have a story. We all have private, personal pain, insecurities, things that we keep close to the vest, you know? And it's been my experience that it wasn't those things that made me an alcoholic, but maybe it was some of those things that contributed to my unmanageability. And today, you know, because I live a sober life and because I live on a basis where I apply the principles of the program to my life, and I have to use introspection, and I have to look at my motives, and I have to trust God, and I have to do all those things. All of these things that really don't have much to do with me being an alcoholic, I have to pay attention to today, because those are the ones that are going to bite me in the butt and bring me back to booze. So this horrible childhood that I had, kidding, didn't make me an alcoholic, but it did make me kind of crazy. I have three brothers and sisters who may or may not have a substance abuse problem. So you can take that in any kind of code you want. And I have one sister who's not an alcoholic, not a drug addict, nothing, and she drinks. I talked to her one day, and I never understood, like, the average temporary drinker. You know those types? I used to think, like, well, doesn't everybody drink like me? I mean, what's the point? I just didn't understand it. And one day I was talking to my sister, and she was saying, well, gee, Kara, you know, you're 23 years old. You haven't drank in, you know, 5-6 years. Maybe it was a phase. And I said, well, Moore, what do you do when you drink? This is my sister Maureen. I said, what do you do when you drink? She says, well, I have a glass of wine. And she says, and I get a little tired. And then she says, if I have two, I really got to go to sleep. And I said, but see, Maureen, when I drink... When I drink, see, I don't bother with a glass. I don't even take it out of the bag. And, you know, basically what stops me from drinking is running out of money, you kicking me out, taking the booze away from me, or I pass out. But then I wake up and I drink again. But so essentially an outside force has to happen upon me to stop me from drinking once I start. So when I said that to her, she said, well, Kara, maybe it wasn't a phase. I really wouldn't want to see you drink. But so the youngest of five, my parents are pretty normal. There's a 10-year age difference between me and my sister Franny, who's the second youngest. So I was like menopause. Like my mom really thought I was menopause. I mean, she was like 40 years old. She went to the doctor, and she's like, wow, the change is coming early. And he said, yeah, big change. You're having a baby. Now, my dad was thrilled. I mean, from what I hear, this is the family legend, that he went to work and he had like a spring in his step. He's like, see, I still got it at 43. Yeah. But so I grew up, you know, and my brothers and sisters were a lot older than me. But see, they had these, you know, these chemical dependency problems. So I saw a lot of drinking and using in my childhood by my, you know, in my brothers and sisters. I mean, I have a distinct memory of watching my sister choke on her vomit. She passed out. Of course, every good alcoholic knows that you go face down and you might bloody your nose, but you're not going to choke on your vomit. But if you fall backwards, you might die. So my sister, she came home one night and she forgot the rule. And she fell backwards onto her bed and was kind of laying there like this. And I remember my mom coming in and checking her because we shared a room. See, my parents were really smart. You know, they said, you know, two moved out. I got two left, and they're 18. I'm not buying a new house having a little kid. We'll just make her live with her sister. But my sister still lives at home, and she's 35. I moved out. So I shared a room with my older sister. and my brother never left either until he got married, and, you know. But I shared a room with my sister, and she was passed out. And my mom, like, came in, and I was, like, five. And she came in, and she saw my sister, and my sister was choking. So she screams and wakes me up. And all I know is I see, like, everyone come running in. My mom shaking my sister, screaming. And, of course, I'm five, so I have no idea what's going on. So I think she's hurting my sister. So I run into defender, and I kind of get knocked over. And everyone's screaming. And my sister finally, she like wakes up out of the stupor, and she starts hitting my mom because, you know, my mom's shaking her, but she didn't realize that my mom was like saving her life. So this is what I saw on a regular basis as a kid. So the amazing thing, and the reason why I share this, is this. Never once did I think, drinking bad. I'm not going to do that. I thought, I'm going to be an alcoholic. That is so cool. I can wear black clothes, and I can pass out wherever I want. I don't have to go to school. You know, this is what I thought. I mean, I idolized my older brothers and sisters. So that was my sister, and my brother shot heroin. So, and then my other brother, but he moved out. He went to the Air Force. Like, they kind of got rid of him. They're like, you're a junk, but you can go. So this is what I saw throughout childhood. So, you know, my parents being perfectly normal, but I, well, as normal as you can get, bad genetic lot, though. But as normal as you can get, but, like, I saw drinking, and I saw this, I mean, alcoholic drinking, and I never, like I said, thought to myself, gee, I don't want to do that. And it seemed perfectly normal to me. And, you know, having, you know, a junkie brother and a drunken sister didn't necessarily help me in school because my sister got thrown out of the junior high school and high school, which I had the distinction of doing so, getting thrown out of the junior high school and high school of my schools. So I've been thrown out of some of the best schools in the state of New Jersey, private schools and everything. I mean, they wouldn't even take our money. They just said, you have to go. We don't want your money. Just go away. So... You know, that didn't necessarily help. And see, the cops would come to my house a lot, you know, because there was always somebody getting arrested for doing something. Or my mom was calling the cops on my brother because he was breaking windows or fighting with my dad. Or my brother would be getting arrested for possession or any number of things. And there would always be, like, huge violent fights and screaming, yelling, and all kinds of things. So I went to school, and I thought everybody else's family was like that. So I'd go over to my friend's house, and when my friends' dads and moms were talking calmly and their brothers and sisters like were helping them with their homework instead of beating the hell out of them, I thought, something's wrong with my family. You know, why can't I have a family like that? Like, why can't I have like a mom who makes cookies and a brother who doesn't beat me up? This would be good, you know? So it really fed my sense of insecurity. You know, I walked around thinking that no one knew who I was. No one could ever possibly understand me, and no one could know. I mean, there were secrets. You didn't tell people what happened in your house. You didn't tell people. I remember, like, sometimes before I was little, when I was little, before I knew, I would let, like, little details about my life and my inner family life slip, and I could see the horrified looks on my friends' faces, like, what do you mean there's a high, you know, you found, you know, like bottles under your sister's bed, or, you know, or you can't go in the house because your brother's going to beat you up. What do you mean? You know, or when I bring a friend home and my brother would curse at us and chase me out of the house with a stick, you know? And so I learned to hide and lie very young. I learned not to let people know who I am. I learned the rules. You don't tell anybody who you are. You lie. You lie, just period. Like, if I could tell the truth, if you asked me what color my shirt was, I would tell you it was blue. I mean, it was green. I knew it was green. Everybody knew it was green. But just lying was so ingrained in me. It was so natural to lie. And you would think, well, I can't tell the difference between blue and green. You know, and that, I mean, it was so convincing. It was so part of my nature. It was just hide. No matter what you do, hide. Never let people see you. You know, and I can remember being extremely insecure at such a young age. And I would lie about the littlest things. Because I wanted power. I wanted you to like me. I didn't want you to know who I was. You know, when I started that so young, like 5, 6 years old, that, you know, by the time I got old enough to start drinking, which was about 8, you know, I had developed many of the characteristics of an alcoholic. You know, I don't believe, and I hear a lot of people talk about the spirit malady. A lot of people talk and say that, you know, I was born an alcoholic, that I was born with the spirit malady, and I don't believe that. I believe that somewhere along the line, something inside of me got broken. But I do not believe my higher power, the God that I believe in, I don't believe could ever make me be born with that part of me missing. But see, there was something missing inside of me. And I don't know how it happened. Just like I don't know how that one day I woke up and I just said, I'm not going to drink today. And I don't know what happened, where that thing happened inside of me, where just this integral piece of me just got thrown away or got broken off or just lost, kind of lost in the mail. I don't know why that integral part of my soul or my spirit just kind of disappeared. But I do know it happened because I know that I was never good enough and I was never like you. And I knew that if you knew me, you were going to hate me, you know? So I was like that at 5. So just think about that for about 2 seconds. With every passing year, I got a little worse, you know? So by the time I picked up alcohol, I had already had like this deep, deep emotional, spiritual problems. And for me, alcohol became a solution to those problems. It gave me relief that nothing else in the world had ever given me, you know? And I like to add, because a lot of women I know have experienced this in their lives, you know, and I don't often talk about it, but I feel that I should. You know, throughout this time, I also experienced, you know, not from a member of my family, but sexual abuse. So between the physical, emotional, and sexual abuse, by the time I reached 13, I was truly certifiably insane. You know, but a lot of women, we get sober and we find out that we have these things in our lives that we have to deal with now. We have to deal with physical abuse, the impacts of that, the sexual abuse, date rape, because, you know, when you're passed out, sometimes it happens, you know? Things happen that happened to me that I had no control over, and they hurt me, and they kept me sick for a really long time. And then when I got sober and I didn't have alcohol to numb that, and reality hit, I was a couple years clean, and I thought, oh my God, I have some major issues I have to deal with. I am really screwed up. Like, I thought I fixed my alcohol problem, and turns out I'm crazy too. You know. But the thing is, and I share about this, because a lot of women don't talk about it. It's something that's hidden. But see, the thing is, and there's this thing in the family afterwards, it says that our past will become an asset. That the most painful aspects, most dark secrets of our lives will become an asset in carrying the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's been my experience. That these things, this physical, sexual, and emotional abuse that I experienced as a very young child has become the greatest asset I've ever had in my life. Because it enables me to help other people. You know, and also I get to set an example saying that you can have horrific things happen to you. And you can not drink. And you can deal with them. And you can be sane, kind of, you know, but I look sane. So, you know, so the sexual abuse started when I was 5 and it went till I was 12. So that was my childhood, essentially. So naturally, when I found alcohol, I thought, oblivion, nice. And my first drink was actually was given to me by a family member. I can remember the day. It was Thanksgiving. And this was the first drink that somebody gave me, not the first drink that I took. And I don't really count this as my first drink because somebody gave it to me. I didn't seek it out, but I'll tell you it anyway because it's my first memory. I was like maybe 4 or 5, and I was wearing a green jumper, a little green dress, and it was Thanksgiving. And my mom gave me this glass of wine, and it was the most beautiful color of amber I had ever seen. And I held the glass in my hand, and I remember thinking, I remember holding it like this, like, I'm so grown up. And I took, you know, drank the wine back, and I think my mom said, well, a 3-year-old, 4-year-old drank that wine a little quick. You know. And I remember her, I don't remember her ever giving me any alcohol again. But, I mean, I remember that. I mean, that was so clear to me that day. I mean, so it kind of says to me that, that somewhere along the lines, I knew, alcohol, good. You know, I made that connection. So, you know, my first drink when I was 9, it wasn't all that interesting, you know, 8, 9 years old, I think. I think it was blackberry brandy, and it was really gross. I threw up, yeah, threw up. Nothing really huge about that. You know, and I guess I expected this. You know, I expected, like, not, like, I was going to start drinking and I was going to be, like, this completely different person. Like, somehow I was going to, well, in America, you know, we think Europeans are much more sophisticated. So somehow I was going to be, like, this sophisticated European woman, you know, at, like, 8 or 9 years old. But the whole point was this, is that, you know, I sought it out and I drank it and I know that I felt differently. And I know that I drank intermittently, you know, until I was about 12, 13 years old. But I didn't... I know that my drinking took on a different nature when I became a teenager. I mean, at that point, it was just kind of like I wanted to feel like a grown-up. Like, I liked drinking because I was doing something that other people didn't know about. And I was sneaking, and I had power, and I could feel older. I could be like my older brothers and sisters, who I thought were the coolest, you know. You know, and so that's kind of why I did it. But I think it was about 7th grade, which is, I think, 12 or 13, 12? 12. I'm not really good with math. I'm always trying to think, like, when did I start drinking? 4th grade. I know it was 4th grade, but I didn't know how old I was. I don't know if I was 8 or 9. And I remember in 7th grade was when my drinking became different. And I think what happened was this, is I went from my elementary school, you know, and it was very, very small. And I went to, like, this junior high school. And this junior high school is like a regional junior high school. And that means that all the 7th graders from all over our town went to this school. And I remember, like, the first day of school, like, I walked in, you know, and I thought I looked really good. This is the 80s, so I had on these leopard print, like, jeans and this big sweater, you know, one of those big sweaters? And I think my hair was, my parents never let me tease my hair because this is, of course, the 80s, and we used to have big hair in New Jersey. And we used to have big hair in the 80s, but really big hair in New Jersey, the higher the better, you know. And my parents never let me tease my hair, but I remember, like, sneaking to the bus stop going, you know, teasing my hair up, spraying it, you know. So I had this big hair, and I walk into my junior high school, and I look around, and every girl in that school was prettier than me. She was thinner. They were smarter. And I said, oh, shoot. I'm in trouble. You know, and I think for me, you know, going into that environment and just feeling like nothing, like I just wasn't good enough, and that, that everyone was better than me, and that you know, just so lost that, you know, I gravitated to the people that I always gravitate to, and that's people like me. So I walked into the bathroom, and there was a bunch of girls smoking in there. And I thought, I like these girls. You know, and I started to talk to them, and all of them were juvenile delinquents, you know, and I said, I like these girls. So I bummed a cigarette, started another addiction, and and I started hanging out with the girls who hung out in the girls' bathroom. And, you know, at that point, like, I gave up on trying to be a good girl. Like, all my life, I always tried to be perfect. I always tried to be this good girl. You know, my parents wanted me, I studied ballet. My parents gave me acting lessons, and I was supposed to be, like, you know, like one of those kids that, like, ever see the parents with their showbiz kids? They're always in these musicals and productions, and these little girls with the bows and the dresses, and, yeah, like JonBenet Ramsey. Well, but I wasn't blonde and pretty like her, but I was, like, one of those girls, like tap dancing in my little tutu and blah, blah, blah. My parents, I was in all these shows and the reviews and singing, dancing lessons, and, you know, and I'd always, like, felt like I, you know, like, was on stage and I had to be perfect, you know. And I walked into that girl's bathroom and I said, screw perfect. I'm not going to do anything. I'm just going to sit here and smoke, and that's what I'm going to do. And, you know, and those girls invited me for a beer after school, and I found my friends. I was popular with the juvenile delinquent set of Bloomfield Middle School, you know. And that carried through the rest of my life until today. But, you know, because in Alcoholics Anonymous, who do we have but the juvenile delinquent set? You know. So I'm perfectly at home. But no, so like I said, it's like at that point, I just said, you know what? I give up. I'm not trying anymore. I'm just going to hide in the girls' bathroom. So, you know, very shortly, I started ditching classes, stopped doing homework, you know, stopped caring, started wearing, like, Megadeth T-shirts, you know, and exactly, you know, became a burnout, and that was good for me, you know? And I didn't want to be pretty anymore because I was always, you know, you always never pretty enough, always have to be prettier, always have to make up. And I just stopped caring, you know, we're, you know, dark, you know, black, hair in my face, black lipstick and Megadeth. And I was perfectly at home, you know, and that kept on for a really long time. And that's who I became. I became Crazy Karen. Now, they literally, that's what they called me in high school. I'm not kidding. Crazy Karen. You know, I was the girl who would set things on fire. I was the girl who had no... I threatened teachers, threatened to kill them, threatened to blow up their cars. They believed me. I was like, you know, like I know how to blow things up. You know, but somehow, you know, Columbine hadn't happened either. So I guess they had thought that it was going to start with me. I, you know, that's what I embraced, being a bad girl, you know, and I was really good at it. But the problem was this, is that I still had this deep desire to be loved and accepted. So I was always at war with myself. Like, I had this desire. I had to be liked. I had to be accepted. I wanted love so desperately, and I wanted to succeed so desperately in so many ways. Yet I had this image, like, I don't care. You know, so I was in this constant state of pain and insecurity and depression and a constant feeling of worthlessness that I carried, you know. And needless to say, the one thing that helped me not to feel like that was the thing that made me unconscious. Because being unconscious, you don't think about whether or not you're worth anything, because you're not really thinking very much at all, you know. And, you know, drinking made me cool. It made me, you know, dangerous, you know. It made me the, you know, like I could be like that special girl. Like, I wanted to be Janis Joplin. I really did. You know, I read No One Gets Out of Here Alive, which is like the story of Jim Morrison, right? And I remember watching The Rose, which of course is liberally borrowed from Janis Joplin's life, and thinking, you know what? I think I found my calling. Disgusting, throwing up, dirty, drunk. Yes! You know, seriously. You know, so I started writing dark poetry very badly. Seriously, I was about eighth grade. I started carrying around like this notebook, and I was always writing dark poetry, and I was very important, and no one knew, like just no one knew how important I was. And one day, like when I died, somebody was going to find my deep, deep, soulful poetry, and I'd become famous. I wasn't grandiose in the least. I started that. So, you know, and what do you do when you're this deep, sensitive artist type? Well, you sit in your room with lots of candles all around, and you drink. You know. And that's what I did. So, you know, it started out like I was drinking with the kids, you know, the juvenile delinquent kids, to fit in with the juvenile delinquent kids. And I started, you know, by like 13, just drinking in my room by myself, writing depressing poetry. And, you know, and I was thinking about how I was going to slash my wrists, you know. So, you know, that's where I ended up. And, I mean, I started drinking in fourth grade. You know, by ninth grade, I was suicidal, homicidal, and lots of suicidals, man. I mean, like, the DSM-4, you know, I was all over that thing, you know. Depression, you know, all kinds of things, and that's the point, you know. That, you know, I became sick, and very sick, very quickly. It was almost like alcohol accelerated. Like, you know that little hole that I was talking about that kind of fell out of my soul at some point? It was like alcohol, like, accelerated the decline. Like, it just made that, like that hole grow. You know, and the more it grew, the more I thought I needed to drink because I couldn't stand reality. You know, sometimes in AA, like, I'll hear, you know, people say, well, you know, they just didn't want it enough. Never hear that? Or they just didn't get honest. Or, you know, they just weren't willing. You know, and what a lot of people don't realize, and it's something that I do, and that was beaten into me by my sponsor, by the way, not because I figured it out on my own, was this, is that, you know, if I don't get relief from God, I will get relief from any method I can find, you know. And the bottom line is this, as an alcoholic, with my spirit malady, what I seek is relief. relief from the emotional torment that I live with if I do not have a higher power in my life. Now, that higher power could be God. It could be anything. It could be booze. But there has to be a power greater than myself working in my life to relieve me from that pain. See, and the thing is, and the amazing thing is this, is that, you know, when I started drinking, those nine-step promises that we talk about, you know, started to come true for me. Booze did for me what I could not do for myself. The problem with booze and the problem with me is not that so much that I have this allergy that says that once I start drinking, I can't stop. It's that I have this mind that tells me that the same thing that's killing me will make me better. You know, I'm kind of crazy, huh? I told you I was crazy, you know? It's like I had this tool, you know. I've heard this put two different ways, and I think it's probably the greatest explanation I have for the alcoholic insanity, you know. And of course, they're not mine. One is that, you know, that alcohol was a broken tool, and my insanity is that I kept thinking that it wasn't broken, that somehow someday this broken tool was going to fix my problem. And the other insanity is this: the other way I've explained is this: is that I had this map. You know, and alcohol is my map for dealing with life. Carrie drinks, and Carrie doesn't have to deal with the pain. Carrie doesn't have to deal with reality. Carrie doesn't have to deal with you. You know, but the problem here is this, is that this map is so way outdated. What used to work, or what used to get me from point A to point B, you know, no longer resembles the path that I need to take. But I keep thinking, if I follow this map, I'll find my way. You know, and that's the way that I related to alcohol. You know, so I drank, and once I started drinking, I couldn't stop. And the only thing that stopped me was somebody else running out of money, getting kicked out, or passing out. And I had this emotional state where I felt like when I wasn't drinking, I didn't have any skin. You ever feel like that? You know what that feels like? Where, like, you don't know where you end and other people begin, and you're so sensitive, so anxious. And it's like, just don't even breathe near me, man. You know? And that's my emotional state when I'm not drinking. Okay? And I have this mind that tells me, you know, just drink, honey. It'll all go away. Just drink. So, naturally, at 13, I started showing up in some mental hospitals. When you think like that and you act like that when you're 8 or 9, by the time you're 13, you're pretty sick. you know, so when I was 13, you know, my parents noticed that I was a little crazy. And they started sending me to shrinks. And, of course, I didn't tell the truth to the shrinks because, God forbid, I tell them, you know, I drink a lot. No, I wasn't going to interfere with my solution. You know, it was everybody else's problem. Everybody else that caused me to drink was because I didn't have a good childhood. Because my brother was mean to me. You know, because, you know, because this guy molested me and because my dad beat me up. That's why I drank. You know, and if you had my life, you would drink too. And I convince them sometimes. I'm telling you. I can roll out the sob story and I can put the tears and they think, what a poor, poor, sweet little girl. They had no idea that I had a knife in my purse. You know, that I figured if I can't convince them that it's everybody else's fault, then I could probably get out of here with this thing. You know, they had no idea, you know. So anyway, I started showing up in rehab. See, in America, Adolescent rehabs are like, they're really psych wards because they put you on this lock ward. It's like rehabs, you know, they don't like let you hang out in a place, you know, and you get to eat, you know, and go to meetings and go to groups. And no, see, you're in a locked ward in a mental hospital, and you have to go through 3 or 4 locked doors in order to get in there. And when you get in there, there's even a locked door on the wing that you're in. And then there's a rubber room with a mattress on the floor. And 4-point restraints. See, that's where I started to get sent. Because that's what I do when I drink. See, I get a little crazy. But actually, I've found that I've been crazier when I'm not drinking. well, I've done the most violent things sober. But I found that, you know, when I'm like that, when I'm in the grips of alcohol, I could do the craziest things. And one of the things that I started doing was eating pills, lots of them. You know, because I figured, I'm 14 years old. Life sucks. Why bother living anymore? I mean, I figure I tasted life. It's violent, scary. People are mean. I don't like anyone. Booze is starting not to work. So I might as well just check out right now. I figure I've tasted life. I don't like it. Maybe I'll be reincarnated to something better, like, you know, a flower or something, or, you know, at least, you know, I could be like a squirrel, you know? You know, so I figured, you know, why not just check out now? So I started to try to do that. But see, like, you know, I didn't do it all that well. And, you know, and so my parents kept finding me, you know, passed out and near death on, like, the floor of the bed or, you know, and my poor parents had to deal with, you know, having this daughter who just wanted to die. So what did I do? So my mom decided, because I started to date drug dealers in the ghetto. I figured I couldn't die by pills, so I figured if I started going down into, like, the ghetto in New Jersey, and the ghetto in New Jersey is, like, something you've never seen before, because trust me, it's scary, okay? Like, burnt-out buildings, drug, you know, like, just people being shot, lots, and bad stuff happening. And see, I was, like, this little girl who, you know, went to prep school and stuff, would start taking the bus, you know, down to St. Joe's and Patterson and started dating drug dealers. And my mom found out that one picked me up at the house and she took one look at him and said, uh-oh. So she brought me back to the mental hospital, which is Carrier, by the way. See, there's this mental hospital in New Jersey, and it's really nice. I mean, they have a swimming pool, and you can make ceramics and belts, and you can hang out there, and I really liked it there. So I tried to go there at least two times a year, because it was kind of like a vacation. So, like, my mom drove me there, and she said, listen, you're either going back into the ward, or you're going to go to your sister's house. So I went to go live with my sister in Pennsylvania. Now, my sister in Pennsylvania is much different than where I grew up in New Jersey. So I grew up in New Jersey in a suburb, and we had, like, sidewalks and, you know, cars and people. And my sister lived in the mountains, and there were no sidewalks, and you were 20 miles from anywhere to get milk. and you're in the middle of nowhere. And I was, like, 15, so I didn't drive. So I was stuck in the mountains, and people, like, went hunting, and they had guns, and, like, they'd run over a deer and put it in the back of their car. You know, these are the people that I moved next to. Yeah, you know, I don't know if you guys can identify. So I'm, like, this Jersey girl, right? You know, with her Megadeth T-shirt, you know, and I moved into Hicksville, you know, and my neighbor shot squirrels with a BB gun. Okay, this was his hobby. So what did I do? So I did what I do best, which is I found people just like me. See, the thing is, like, you could take me you could put me anywhere, and I'll, like, say, all right, now who here is an alcoholic? And I'll find you. I have alcoholic radar, and usually I pick people who I think are worse than me because you make me look better. Because if I take care of you, then I'm not going to get that bad. But the problem was just that slowly I was running out of people who were worse than me. You know, at first it was pretty easy to find. And now, like, I was the bad one. I was the one that everybody else hung out with in order to feel better about themselves. You know? So I was living in Pennsylvania with my sister. And so when you take an alcoholic, you put them in the woods, and you don't allow them to get access to alcohol, what happens? Yeah. Yeah, so what I did was I went a little crazy, and I didn't leave my room for about 6 months. I slept all the time. I was, like, really depressed, and then I found, and towards the middle of the year, I found friends who were just like me, and I started drinking again. But see, this time, like, I swore, I said, you know, all right, I got into a lot of trouble, you know, in Bloomfield, where I lived in New Jersey, and, you know, I can start over in Pennsylvania. Like, I could be a good girl this time. Like, I can, like, pretend that stuff never happened, that I didn't, you know, date drug dealers, and I didn't slash my wrists, and I didn't, you know, eat pills, and I didn't, like, want to die every day. Like, I could just pretend that I'm one of those nice girls, and no one has to know that that I'm crazy or that I'm an alcoholic. Well, because I didn't know I was an alcoholic. I thought I was crazy. No one has to know that I'm crazy. So I tried so hard. But what I found was this, is that my window of being normal was getting smaller and smaller. You know, every once in a while I'd get in trouble and I'd be good for a little while. You know, I'd be like, I'll be good, Mom. I will stop stealing from you. I'll stop sneaking out my window. I'll stop drinking with my friends, I swear. And I could do it for a little bit. You know, but I was finding as I went along that those those windows of opportunity were getting smaller and smaller, you know, and that I, as much as I wanted to control myself, I couldn't. You know, in the big book, we talk about this. We say that the most desperate desire to stop drinking will be of no avail. And I know that I thought, well, you know, I got thrown out of my house. I got sent to live with my oldest sister and her four kids. And she's in the middle of a divorce. You know, so, you know, I got exiled to my sister's house in the mountains, you know. And my mom wasn't speaking to me. My brother, the junkie, thought I was messed up. You know, everyone wasn't talking to me. Everyone in my family hated me, and I became the case. You know, think about that for 5 minutes. We got three other substantially challenged people in my family, and I was the sick one. And I wasn't even the one shooting heroin. Oh, man. You know, so I became the case, you know, and it's like, I didn't want to be that. You know, I didn't want to be the disappointment. I didn't want to be the one that they had to hide and no one talked about. I didn't want to be the one when my mom would talk to her friends and they'd ask about me, she'd change the subject because she didn't want to have to lie. So I tried so hard. But the thing is like I couldn't stand to be in my own skin. I couldn't look in the mirror. You know, all the things I had done when I was drinking and all the torture I put my family through, when I looked in the mirror, that's all I saw. All I saw was somebody that I hated. You know, I thought that, you know, I was going to be an alcoholic and I was going to be cool. You know, I was going to be like, you know, Janice, and I was going to like, you know, I was going to be cool. I didn't think that I'd become like this loathsome creature who, you know, slept all day, stayed up all night, couldn't go outside, couldn't look at other people, you know, would look at her shoes everywhere I went, couldn't even bear to take a shower because I might have to look in the mirror, you know? So I would just hide. So, you know, I gave up on trying to be a good girl. And I met some friends who did what I did. And I started drinking with them again. And before I knew it, I was way worse than where I was when I got sent to Pennsylvania. So now, my sister, I'm a raging alcoholic. On my poor sister who's in the middle of divorce with four children. So, of course, I got kicked out of my sister's house and get sent back to New Jersey. You know, and I went back and I said, you know what? Okay, I'm going to start over again. This time I'm really going to do it. You know, and I had managed because I had spent 6 months trying to be a good girl and spending most of my time being suicidal and depressed in my room. You know, I managed to do pretty well in school because up until that point, like, I didn't go to school. You know, I was suspended all the time because I was setting fires or fighting, you know. You know, so I was, because I was really violent. So if I didn't like you, I didn't say, I don't like you. I said, I'm going to punch you in the face. And I did. Half the time I didn't tell you I was going to punch you in the face. I just went over a desk at you and started punching you in the face. I didn't know that you can tell people, you know, I don't like the way you treat me. I figured my fist was telling you that. So, you know, my sponsor had to do some work with me on that one. So, yeah, so... So I had managed to pull my grades up, so I ended up getting into this really good private school. Like, they didn't know I was crazy, but, you know, but my grades looked good, and I cleaned up, and I managed to go to the interview, and so I ended up in this really good private school, and had I graduated from it, I would be in a Ivy League college right now and be doing quite well. But I didn't last there more than 3 months, and I have to say, about a month and a half of that, I was on the psych ward. So I was there for 2 months. I got sent to the psych ward because I went crazy again. And then when I say go crazy, I mean I went crazy drinking. Like, I would run away. I would start drinking. I'd run away. I'd disappear. I would become very violent. I'd sneak back into my parents' house, and I would steal money. And if they tried to stop me, I'd hit my mother. Yeah, I hit my mom. Think about that. You know, or I would, you know, curse and scream, break things, break windows, kick open doors. You know, if you were in my way, I was knocking you out because, like, I wanted what I wanted. And what I wanted was money for booze. And nothing was going to stop that. I didn't care who you were. You could be the president of the United States, and I'm sorry. You better move. You know? So, So, you know, I got into school. It took me about 2 weeks or 2 months, and I ended up back in the psych ward, back in rehab. And I was there for about a month and a half, and then I got left there, and I went back to school, and I couldn't stay sober, and so I got thrown out of that school again, and then I got sent back to the original school that I started in, and by then I was so bad. So in that year, I probably, and there was like 3 suicide attempts over the summer, and I was in the psych ward about 3 times. So in that year, I ended up being in a locked ward and in 4-point restraints at least 5 times. yeah. So what happened was this, was that I ran away again, and I was dating a kid. His name was Spawn of the Devil. And he lived in this, like, house that was condemned, and his father's name was Cowboy, and he was a coke dealer. And he was a coke dealer who drove a taxi, and his house was like this crash pad, but it had no doors, even on the bathroom. And I used to sleep on the floor there, and there was like roaches, and like, well, if it had the bathroom door, or the bathroom had no door, imagine what the rest of the house looked like, okay? And I would sleep on the floor there. I would just pass out wherever it was. And so, you know, I was on a runaway. And I went back to my parents' house, and I was going to steal because my mom was at work. And it turned out, like, my mom had decided not to go into work that day. So I'm at the front door, and I'm picking the lock, actually, because I hadn't had a key in my parents to my parents' house in a really, really long time because I'd steal. And they started putting nails in the windows because we had the wooden window frames so that I couldn't lift them up. And they started to put 2x4s in the tops of the windows so that I couldn't lift them up. And my sister put a deadbolt, several locks on her door. You know, my parents locked their door from the inside because they were afraid that I was going to kill them in their sleep. Yeah, that was really pleasant. So I broke into my parents' house. Or I was trying to get into my parents' house. My mom answered the door. And she told me basically, you know, either go to rehab or you go away. So I said, bye. And I went back to the park, and I waited to see if she left. And I figured she had to go to work at some point. The woman has to leave the house, and I'm sure I could find something to steal. You know, I stole jewelry and sold it and all kinds of things like that. And I'm sure I could find something. So I thought she left, but she didn't. And I tried to break back into the house, and my mom called the Bloomfield police. So what ended up happening is I ended up fighting about 6 police officers in my parents' living room. I mean, I was biting, kicking, screaming, scrapping, because I was feral. That's what I did. I just did. I mean, like, I'd hit you before I'd talk to you. So so I was fighting Bloomfield police officers, and I didn't win. And I got a police escort to my last rehab. And they waited with me until they walked me up to the ward. And they made sure I went in. But what happened was this, is that, you know, throughout all this, I had been exposed to AA, but I hadn't really cared too much about it, you know, because it was everybody else's problem why I drank. And I was too angry, too bitter, and I had so much self-loathing that I didn't even want to try. So I'd gone to meetings, and I'd gone to stuff, I'd gone to different fellowships, but nothing seemed to be working for me, you know, because I still believe that if I just did something a little differently, that I can drink like everybody else, you know. And I didn't want to believe that that I am not like other people. So I went into this rehab, and I got exposed to AA. And I left, and I started attending AA, but I did what you're not supposed to do, which is 90 dances in 90 days. I made coffee, got a boyfriend, never read a step, touched a step, did a step. I didn't really have a sponsor. I just kind of hung out in AA, and I did something that in AA that I'm still making amends for today, which is I did a lot of lying. See, the thing is that I found that if I went to AA and I told you a story, any story, that I wouldn't have to tell you what was really going on with me. So I'd go to discussion meetings, and I'd just come up with whatever it was. Like, I'd be watching Jerry Springer, and I'd be like, yeah. And I'd go in there, and I'd just tell this story because it was entertainment value. I wanted to shock people. I wanted to see what they would do. It was like kind of, I was making fun of AA because I'd be like, they believe me. you know? So I didn't really stay sober. I stayed sober for about a year. And I met a guy who was about 3 days sober. And I thought, he was 25 and I was 17. I was just turning 18. And he was a convicted criminal who had spent 2 years in prison. And I thought, my mom is going to love him. I mean, he was way better than the 28-year-old that I had been sleeping with in order to have a place to stay. You know, because I ran away. When I right before I relapsed, I ran away on Mother's Day. Yeah. I told my mother to F herself, and I walked out the door. And I walked out the door, and I got on the back of a motorcycle with this really big, fat biker guy. I mean, he was really, But see, the thing is that he let me stay at his place, and I had no problem doing that. I would use anybody and anything to get what I wanted. If you'd buy booze for me, you were my best friend. And if you'd be dumb enough to let me stay at your house, I'd stay at your house, rob you blind, you know, until you figured it out, and then I'd find another mark. And I thought I found another mark in this guy, you know. But he turned out he was pretty sick, too. And he wasn't going to do all that much taking care of me, so... Because the whole thing is I was looking for somebody to take care of me, you know, and I'd use you up and spit you out. And I'd use my sob story of my horrible life in order to distract you from my hand reaching for your wallet. I had no problem doing that. So I met this guy, I relapsed, and I spent about 90 days drinking. And the little bit of progress that I did make in the time that I had been clean was totally wiped away. I became homeless again. I lost my job. I got a job, and then I lost it. My parents were barely speaking to me. I was about 85 pounds. I looked like death. And I was just absolutely a shell of a person. And I remember, like, just sitting in the bathroom in the apartment that I got and then lost, and I remember thinking, if this is, you know, again, if this is what life is, you know, I don't want to do this. But I had already had some taste of AA, even though, like, I spent most of my time lying and manipulating, getting people to give me rides, do this, do that, feel sorry for me, give me money, yeah, you know, give me a place to stay, you know, take care of me. I spent, you know, time doing that, but I realized that people in AA were very, 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 very nice. And even though I was a crazy psycho who took advantage of them at every turn, they still were nice to me. You know, so that fateful morning that I told you about when I first started talking, when I woke up and I crawled out of a basement, and I thought to myself, I said, you know, I really need to stop this drinking thing. You know, and I said to my future husband, I think we need to go back to AA. You know, and I walked about 3 miles, I think it was like 3 miles, to an AA meeting, and it happened to be a Big Book meeting, so I promptly stole the Big Book. Yeah, I made amends for that, by the way. I promptly stole a Big Book, and I started to go back to meetings. But the thing is this. I didn't take care of, you know, the reason why I spent all this time telling you about how sick I was because when I stopped drinking, I didn't stop being sick. I got worse. And see, this amazing thing happened to me in the first month of my sobriety. I got pregnant because I really listened to suggestions. And I got pregnant. So for 9 months, I had a reason not to drink. And that was long enough for me to start doing some kind of work. Now, mind you, my first 4-step had 3 columns, first, second, and third. And then I took the step book, and then the step book and the 4-step, it has like a list of questions that you're supposed to answer yes or no to. So I did. And that was my first 4-step. But I tried, man. I was trying to do something. But see, the whole thing is, I always say this. I say this on the podium all the time. Why the heck didn't Bill write the 4th column on that page? I only look at the pictures. I don't read the text. Had he put the 4th column on that page, I might have actually written a 4th column. But he had to just, you know, I often said, had I written the Big Book, I would have written differently. And I rewrite the Big Book all the time. I add things like musts, all, you know, I put kind of put back some of the stuff that was taken out of the big book, you know, from the, between the first edition and our current edition, because I'm a little bit fanatical. Just a little. So, yeah, because you have to be. When you're crazy, I mean, man, you got to be fanatical or you will go crazy. You know, so when you're as sick as I am, like, you know, I feel like this. Is I think that sometimes the big book, the program, it's like I call it the coffee program. And I call it like this. I say that some people can drink decaf. I don't understand decaf drinkers. I think you should just drink water. What's the point? I mean, it's the same thing with booze. It's like it doesn't taste all that good. I mean, I drink for effect. I drink coffee for effect. Everything I do in my life is for effect. I pray for effect. I do the 12 steps for effect, man. I don't want to drink. You know? Everything, I'm an alcoholic through and through, man. And that's just the way I am. So everything I do is for effect. And so I don't really get that whole decaf coffee drinker thing, but the whole thing is this, is that I think that, you know, I'm a triple, quadruple espresso girl. And that means this, is that I need program strong, I need program now, I need God now, I need a God injection right now. And nothing but that will do. Because I am that crazy. And I am one of those people, if I do not have that, I will kill myself and others. See, alcohol kept me from killing myself and others. And when I didn't have alcohol, I tried to kill myself and others. And without God, I will try to kill myself and others. And this is how it works. But for me, you know, maybe you should write a four-step. Maybe you should make some amends. Maybe you should say you're sorry is not good enough for me. I need a smack in the head and a kick in the butt and say, go do that now. You know, and I'll do it, you know. I'm a little better, you know, because after 9 years of getting some results, I'm hooked on results. So now I do it because of my past experience. But when I first started doing the work, I need someone to, you know, shove my head in the book and give me a kick in the butt, put a pen in my hand and smack me in the head. And I had plenty of people who were willing to do that. In fact, they were waiting in line. They're like, I couldn't wait to get you. Yeah, so my first time I perused the steps, you know, I did a really crappy job, but I tried to do something, and I think that's what kept me sober until I was about 2 years clean, and I wandered into a big book meeting, and I had no idea what I wandered into. Now, my husband had gotten involved in a group of people who were bringing people through the steps in their home, and they bring a whole group through, you know, and I thought, you know, it's not fair. He's got friends that I don't have. And he's doing something that I'm not allowed to do, and I want that too. Like, I didn't really go there because, like, I had no idea what I was going to get from that experience. I just knew he was doing something, and I wasn't involved, and I needed to be there too. So I found this guy who was willing to bring me through the steps, and I started going through the steps for the big book. And this group was in Staten Island, and the guy who started this group was Joe Hawk's sponsor. So, just think, you know, it was some really intense big book working going on there. And, you know, I really didn't know what I was getting involved in, but my ego, my pride, and my feelings of not being left out, my desire not to be left out, tricked me into getting involved in a big book group. And I started to go through the steps, and I had some amazing results. You know, it's been my experience that the first couple times I went through the steps, I was just kind of learning, like, how to be honest. I was learning how to deal with other people, and it was like a trial run. I think that the more I work the program, the more inventories I do, the deeper I go within myself, I think the more clarity I get. See, the thing is, and this is what I believe, is that I lacked clarity. See, because I believe that it was things outside of me that caused my problems, and I thought if I could fix things outside of me, that my problems would go away. And what I didn't understand is that my problem was the fact that I could not look at things for what they really were. That I always lived on if onlys. If only he would treat me better. If only you would understand me. If only blah, 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 blah. You know, always it was always about trying to control other people in order to make me comfortable. Because the fact is that what I came to understand is that I had a deep feeling of worthlessness. And I believe that if you really knew who I was, that you would run screaming from me. Like, inside of me was this deep black pit. And that you all saw it. That everybody who saw me would see this pit, this deep black cancer within me. And that you know, no one would ever truly love me because of it. you know. And so I spent a lot of time filling it with alcohol, filling it with people, filling it with men, filling it with anything or anyone that would distract me from the fact that I believed that I was nothing. You know, so I went through the steps and I found this out. But what I found out was that I wasn't the only person in the world who felt like that. That these people that helped me, they understood what the hell I was talking about. For the first time in my life, I felt like, oh my God, oh my God, I am not alone. But beyond not being alone, because I had been in AA long enough to know that there are lots of alcoholics, but I never knew that pain, that self-hatred, that feelings of worthlessness, that we all had that. That's why we drank. I never understood that. Like, I thought you guys all drank, but inside you were okay. I had no idea. And see, what happened was that these people who helped me and brought me through the steps showed me that. They told me, they showed me those pages in the big book, and they're from the Icelandic big book, but it's pages 60 to 63, and it talks about the actor. You know, when somebody sat down with me and they explained to me what those words really meant, when they talked about, you know, trying to control circumstances and people in order to feel okay, to feel important, to feel like you're something or somebody, in order to just feel. You know, and when they explained that to me, because I would be like, oh, the actor, that's somebody else, that's not me. You know, and what happened was the people who brought me through the work, they said, well, why don't you stop saying he and say I? So I am selfish, self-seeking, dishonest, and frightened. I'm driven by 100 forms of fear, self-seeking, delusion, self-pity, blah, 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 yada, yada. I'm like, oh, yeah, I am. That's nice to know. So I found out my problem wasn't that I drank. I found out my problem wasn't that I had a messed up family. I found out that my problem wasn't because I had a horrible childhood and nobody loved me. I found out my problem was that I was a selfish, self-seeking, dishonest person, and that I was looking for everybody in my life to give me a sense of self. That if you told me I was okay, then I was okay. See, I really believed that, you know, if you thought that I was good, if you thought that I was pretty, if you thought that I was smart, then that was true. But see, if I didn't have you to tell me that, then I wasn't any of those things. And anybody who thought that I wasn't, well, damn it, I was going to show you that I was. I would prove to you that I am the smartest, prettiest, most wonderful girl on the face of the earth. And if you didn't believe it, damn, I'll make you. And I'll keep making you until you do or you run away. You know? You know, and I didn't realize that. But that's when I began to understand that I made everybody and everyone my higher power. Everyone in my life was God but God. You know, I found out that third column, those seven areas of self that we talk about, that what I was doing is I was looking for whoever it was that I was resentful at to make those things come true. I wanted you to validate my ambitions, to validate my self-esteem, to validate my pocketbook, my personal relationships. I wanted you to make me feel important. And if you failed to do so, then I hated your guts because, damn it, I needed you. You were my drug. So that's what I'm like when I'm not drinking. So that's why I'm crazy all the time. And that's why I needed God, because there's nothing in this world, there's no human power that could fix that. Just like there was no human power that could make me wake up one day and say that I wasn't going to drink. You know, and there's no human power that can make that feeling go away. And I tried all different ways in AA not to feel that way, but the steps, because God forbid I do those. And eventually, they talk about, in the big book, we talk about in the last analysis, we go to God, and you know, and that it's only there that we will find it. You know, in last analysis, I go within. Deep down inside, every man, woman, and child is a fundamental idea of God. We must search fearlessly, but he's there. And what does that searching fearlessly mean? It means writing a fourth step, doing a fifth step, clearing away all those things that block me from God, and looking within. What do I really believe? I didn't know what I believed about God. I hated God because I thought God made all those people hurt me. So there was no way I was going to go to God to fix my alcoholism because he made me that way, gosh darn it. You know, so deep down inside, every man, woman, and child was a fundamental idea of God, and there was one within me. And it took a lot of searching, and it took a lot of people loving me. You know, it took me watching God work in other people's lives before I began to believe that God could work for me because I was so bankrupt. I was so bankrupt and so frightened and so closed that I really didn't believe that God could work for me. And I believed, and this is what I believe, that I was too broken for God. Like, I figured God could fix all you guys, but he wasn't going to fix me because I was way sicker than you. Right? That remains to be seen. But the point is that from my perception, God wasn't going to fix me, you know. But what my sponsor said is this. She said, why don't you try a God experiment? Now, when I say sponsor, I want to explain this because it would take me 2 hours to explain to you exactly how I got from the first step to the ninth step, because I went through a lot of different people who helped me get through the steps, because somebody was put in my life for the first three steps, and then somebody stepped in and helped me write a four step, because I wasn't actually sponsored by a woman for the steps until I was 5 years sober, because nobody did the steps where I lived. I ended up moving away from Staten Island to New Jersey, and people didn't know. They thought, you know, they thought the steps were something on the wall. Okay? You know, I'd go to meetings, and I'd be like, I wrote a four-step. And they'd be like, oh, you wrote your story? And I'd be like, what? They'd be like, don't do that. You're going to drink. I'm like, dude, I already did it. You know, but the thing is, that our people will go up to the girls that I was trying to help and say, stay away from her. She's a little strange. You know, they used to say that because I was, you know, sick. And now they're saying that because I was trying to say, you know, why don't you write a step? Do you really know what an alcoholic is? You know, that whole thing. Like, what does being an alcoholic really mean? You know, because you go to New Jersey and sometimes you'll sit in a meeting and people don't really know the answer. They don't know about craving, mental obsession, or spiritual malady. Those things are things that they don't understand. That ended up on my inventory, by the way. I no longer resent people who don't work the steps because I figure I can't help them if I'm mad at them. I can't be effective. If they think that I'm feeling superior to them, then how am I going to be effective in carrying the message to them? And ironically, I end up sponsoring women with 20, 25 years of sobriety because I don't judge them. And I just say, hey, I do this, and this is what works for me. I used to be crazy, and now I'm not. And they see me with my children. They see me with my husband. They see me in my life. They see that I smile every day and that I'm happy in adversity. And I say, oh, man, maybe she is. Maybe she's either crazy, but it's kind of crazy I want. Or, you know, maybe she really is happy and she's doing something. She's got something I don't have. So I end up sponsoring women with, you know, twice as old as me. I mean, I'm 27. So, you know, I end up sponsoring women 20 years older than me, 20, 25 years of sobriety, several of them. And everybody thinks I'm their daughter. They'd be like, they bring me, I go to their celebrations and stuff. And you know, everybody comes up and I'm like, are you so-and-so's daughter? And they look and they smile like, no, that's my sponsor. Everybody looks, huh? You know, we get a kick out of it now. Now it's like a huge joke, you know. Or people can't believe that I'm their sponsor. They believe, they're like, oh, is that your sponsor? And I'm like, no, I'm her sponsor. And now I stop correcting people. I don't like, I walk into a meeting when somebody says, are you new? I say, yes. You know, because when you're 20-something years old and you're walking to meetings and people automatically assume that you're pretty new because you look young. And it's kind of hard to put young and time and sobriety together. So instead of correcting people, because when you do that, what happens is this, is that then people won't ask the newcomer because they don't want to look stupid. So they'll stop going up and introducing themselves to newcomers because they don't want to offend anybody. So instead, I pretend like I'm new and I let them practice their skills because I am. I'm new. So, you know, give me a list of names and I'll call them, you know, show me to a seat, give me a cup of coffee, fine. And I love that, you know, and I stop correcting the people who can't believe that I sponsor the women I sponsor. And they say, is she your sponsor? I say, yeah. You know, and they're like, because they are. The women I sponsor me. Because, you know, throughout all of this, and I told you how crazy I was and how sick I was and how dark and lonely and frightened I was. And all the things that I did. Oh, and by the way, did I mention I was dead for 2 minutes? Some of those suicide attempts actually worked. You know, I actually died. I mean, I wasn't kidding. I really, really, really hated myself. You know, and I used to cut up my arms and my legs, and I really hated myself. And I actually did die. So, you know, I forgot what I was saying. Never mind. So anyway, so let's go back to that. So the steps gave me the ability to love myself, because the people that worked with me and the people that helped me through each phase of my recovery, you know, their love, their guidance, they're sitting with me at their kitchen table and teaching me the steps. The fact that these women would take the time out of their lives, these people would take time to listen to my fifth step or to advise me on amends or just to talk to me after a meeting. You know, I had a green mohawk and I had like earrings in my nose and I carried knives and I'm covered in tattoos, but I had really bad tattoos then. You know, I have like lots of tattoos, but I had really bad tattoos then. And I had like, you know, ripped ripped, well, I wear ripped clothes too, but dirty ripped clothes, you know? And I was just disgusting when I came into AA and when I was going to meetings. And I go to meetings drunk and I go to meetings high and I go to meetings in all kinds of states, you know? And those people helped me, you know, and they listened to me. And as I got better, they were willing to give me their time and teach me how to do the steps and teach me how to sponsor and hold my hand, you know? But, the most amazing thing, and I'll tell you the two most amazing things that have happened to me in recovery, other than going to Iceland, that's on my list now, three. And other than having my children, but you know, that's kind of said. I mean, you can't have children without thinking that's amazing. But so two non-children or Iceland-related things that have happened to me in my recovery is that one day I'd been through the steps and I, you know, was working on my amends and I'd done a real thorough four step and I had done this work and I was listening to a fifth step and I'm talking to this woman and I'm helping her see her part and I'm giving her this love, like I'm hearing her pain and I feel like this overwhelming sense of love for her and I realized that I'm not crazy anymore. And then I'm not dead anymore inside. And then I can help people. That all of that pain meant something. And I realized that I did have a spiritual awakening. That I could be healed. And I could have that. That God could be inside of me. So I always talk about that and cry because it's the most amazing thing that happened to me in my life. Is that I was able to help somebody else. And now I sponsor, like, on the average 10 or 15 women. I've heard, like, at least 200 fifth steps, and I do the most amazing work in AA, and I do it. I mean, this crazy girl that no one would talk to in a meeting who would carry knives because somebody in the meeting might hurt her could sit in a room with a woman who was twice her age and listen to her tell her about her problems and love her. You know, this other thing happened. Through sponsoring, I started working with somebody who was... He was a transvestite, so he was a her, and he wanted a female sponsor. And in his story, he began to tell me how he had this this thing in his past that he had abused somebody sexually. And I'm a victim of sexual abuse. And I'm sitting listening to him tell me this, and I realize that I don't hate him, and I don't want to hurt him. And then I realized how broken he really was and how much pain he was from what he did. And I loved him. That I didn't take out my pain from what happened to me on him. That I could put aside my personal experience and love this person. Even though, like, every person who's ever experienced any kind of physical or sexual abuse just wants to get some abuser and get him in the corner and give it to him. You don't care if it's your abuser or anybody's abuser. You just want to take out that revenge. But at 8 years sober, I didn't want revenge anymore. I just wanted to help this person heal. And I didn't judge him, and I loved him. You know, and that to me, in the 12-step work, is the most amazing thing, that I can hear some of the most horrific, frightening. I can listen to people's pain that is so great. I mean, I used to think I had a horrible life, and then I've heard the lives of some of the women that I work with, and I thought, wow, I'm a lucky girl. Seriously. You know, and I can listen to their pain, and I can help them. You know, and that for me is the most beautiful experience in the world. But the way that I get to a place where I can do that is by working the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I can't listen to another person's pain and not be codependent unless I'm in the right spiritual space. I don't get into that spiritual space without doing 4 through 9, 10, 11, and 12. If I don't live in 10, 11, and 12, there's no way that I can be effective as a sponsor. If I'm not connected to God, I am absolutely useless to every human being on the face of the earth. Trust me. You know, I've proven that, you know. And there's this other amazing thing that happened to me in my recovery. Now, I told you about, like, how I treated my mother. You know, I hit her. I stole from her. I got arrested in front of her. I did really, really bad things to my mommy. And it took me 5 years to make amends. See, I went and made lots of amends. Like, I'd go with my 9-step card, and I'd go say I was sorry. But, like, I always still thought, well, if only you were a better mother, then I wouldn't be so sick. Like, that's just what I thought. I said, well, only if you were a better mom, then I wouldn't be in as much pain. And if only you treated me better, if only you had read Dr. Spock, if only you kicked my junkie brother out, if only you had protected me, if only you had done A, B, and C, then I wouldn't be in so much pain. So, you know, I'm making amends to you, but I really think that you should have done a better job. Now, I never actually said, well, I did say those things in the past, but in my amends, I never actually said that, but I felt it in my heart. And see, in the ninth step, we talk about going to someone and frank and honest. And I also said that we should be in a forgiving spirit. So whenever I made amends to my mom, it was never really in the forgiving spirit. It was always just to check it off my list to say I was done. And so when I was 5 years sober, I met a woman, her name was Cass. And this woman had a daughter who was just like me. And so this woman taught me exactly what I put my mother through. And she listened to my fourth and fifth step. And when I went to make the amends to my mother, like through doing the fifth step with Cass, and she shared with me what she went through with her daughter and her daughter's alcoholism and the pain that she had experienced and the regret that she had experienced because of the mistakes she had made in raising her daughter and looking at her daughter being an alcoholic and being in all this pain, saying, well, if only I had done this better. And she had said to me, well, you always go to your mom and you think that, and your mom senses that. So, you know, she said that, and I said, shh, that's not true. I forgive my mom. You know, I'm not mad at her. But, like, every time, like, she'd do something that reminded me of, like, my childhood, I'd flip out on her. I'd yell at her, curse at her, do all the things that I usually do. So, what I did was this, is that she did that, and I went home and I prayed on it, because whenever I do a fist step with somebody, or whenever I do a fist step, you know, I always sit in that quiet hour afterwards, and I thought about what Cass had said and said, you know, is that really true? And I realized, you know, that it really was, that I never really went to my mom in the spirit of amends. I always went there to check her name off the list. So I took the bit in my teeth and went back and made amends to my mom. And the one thing I had wanted from my mom my entire life was for her to say that she was sorry. Like, I wanted her to admit that somehow she had screwed up in raising me. Because what had happened eventually is that I kind of became the scapegoat for, like, all the problems that had happened in my family. And I became the reason why everybody wasn't happy. So I had always felt kind of victimized by that. So what I did was this, is that I went back and made amends to my mom. And I said, you know what, I don't care if she's sorry, if she ever says that she's sorry. I just want to have a decent relationship with this woman. So I went back and I made this amends. And you know what happened? I finished my amends. And my mom said to me, she said, you know, I know you didn't have a very good life. And I'm sorry for what I did. The one thing I had been waiting for 20-something years, she finally did. And it happened when I didn't need it anymore. When I was okay, when I didn't need her apology, when I no longer demanded these things from her, and when I loved her just because of who she was and because she gave me life. She said she was sorry. And that's why, you know, when I talk about the ninth step, when I go make those amends today, I don't do it to check the name off the list anymore. I do it because I want to set right the wrong. And you know, today, my mom's watching my children while I'm here. And I haven't had an argument with that woman in a couple of years. My husband's here. He'll tell you. I'm not lying. You know? And I couldn't go like a week without screaming at her. You know? And the point is this, is that what has happened to me as a result of the 12 steps in Alcoholics Anonymous is that I've gone from somebody who couldn't stand to be alive to somebody who's full of life and is happy and is useful to their family, is loved, who hasn't been arrested in 10 years almost. But that's a good thing, you know. Somebody who hasn't raised a hand in anger to somebody and I don't remember how long. You know, somebody, you know, and it's not on my power that this has happened. It's happened because of God. Because of the God that I've gained access to through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, through the 12 steps. You know, and I remain in contact with that God through 10, 11, and 12, and through carrying the message of Alcoholics Anonymous, through sponsoring. You know, and, you know, these have been the greatest things that have ever happened to me in my life. You know, and there's evidence of the healing that can happen in these rooms. You know, and that's why I tell this story, and that's why I tell it the way I do, is because what it was like was that I was a wreck of a human being. What happened is I found the love in this room, the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and the power of God that can work in and through me. And what it's like now is that I'm a full-time college student. I'm the mother of two children. I'm married. I sponsor women like you wouldn't believe. I am happy, useful in a way that I've never known before in my life. And, you know, I don't have a lot of money. I don't have a lot of prestige. I don't have a lot of it. A lot of those things. I may drive a Hyundai. But I'm grateful for every single thing that I have. And that, to me, is the greatest gift that I've ever been given in my life. because nothing I ever had was good enough. Now everything I have is gold. And that's all I have. Thank you.